Hello and welcome to another Current Affairs edition of Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. We'll be looking at some of the latest issues affecting the property industry. I'm joined today by Chris Norris, Director of Policy and Practice at the National Landlords Association, and Nigel Lewis, Head of Content at The Negotiator. Lots to cover today. Firstly, we have not just a new housing minister, but a newly named government department, don't we, Chris?
We do. We have a ministry now.
And tell us who the ministers are, because there's two actually, aren't there?
Well, there's two, not including the Secretary of State. We've now got a Minister of State who is Dominic Raab, and we have an Under Secretary of State in Heather Wheeler, which is actually quite an interesting change. We've not had a more junior minister responsible for housing and particularly the private rented sector for quite a few years.
What does that signal, Chris?
From our point of view, it signals a bit more time. I know from the last time that we had a similar position, we've got to go all the way back to the Brown ministry before the 2010 election. And it meant we had a minister whose, I suppose you might say, their time wasn't quite as valuable. And it meant we could get a bit more access. So that would be very useful. But they're very new in position, and we've got to hope they stay for longer than about 6 months.
Exactly. And in fact, Nigel, I think this is the seventh minister since 2010. How are you feeling about all of this chopping and changing?
Well, it makes for a wonderful journalistic life for me, because every 6 months or so there's something to report, which is a new minister coming. However, I think it falls into that question falls into two answers. One is that I'm rather sceptical that the ministers really are that committed to the housing sector, to be honest with you. I'll have to declare an interest here, which is I had a Twitter spat with Mr. Raab not that long ago, which he called my content tripe, and was very unhappy about some content. Some comments I made about his attendance at the housing gathering that Theresa May had organised. He's probably disliked me, and I dislike him. However, that's by the by. What I'm more worried about is that really these ministers don't have necessarily great housing track records, and this means that they have a lot of catching up to do very fast in order to be effective in making policy, in making decisions, and that's what worries me the most about this constant revolving door.
That was true, Chris, of Alex Sharma, wasn't it? Because he was minister for just 8 months. And in fact, he came from an accounting background, I think.
He did. And there were a lot of questions asked at the time about whether he had the background, he had the specialist knowledge. I think in the case of the Minister of State now, he comes from a legal background, a commercial legal background, and has been criticised quite openly for having no real background or possibly views on housing. He's certainly from arguably a hard right background. He's certainly from I want to be careful what I say here if spats happen. He's certainly from a kind of liberal with a small L background. And it's going to be interesting to see what he has to say about intervention. But I know we've met so far, the NLA that is, with Heather Wheeler. She seems to have maybe not the background, but a commitment to housing. And she wants to see these things through her constituency background, from what we can tell. So she's very much aware that there are issues there, but only time will tell how seriously they're taken.
Okay, well, we'll look at some of the changes that are coming up in terms of regulation and legislation shortly, but I wanted to look at a couple of policy issues first of all. Pets and landlords and tenants, indeed, have been in the news recently. Sue Hayman, Labour's Shadow Environment Secretary, said that people shouldn't be denied the joy of keeping a pet just because they can't afford a home of their own. And what the Labour Party are proposing is that tenants would have the right or default right to have a pet in their home. What do you think about this, Nigel?
I think that's fair enough. I'm not a massive pet fan myself, but I think that if a landlord is prepared to accept someone with a pet, that's fine. But the tenant, and if the law requires them to do that, that's equally fine by my measure. But what the tenant will have to accept is that there's going to be a much higher cost of exiting the property when they leave, because the cost of restoring a property to a non-smelly environment, and I'm sorry to dog and cat owners out there, but they do smell probably on average more than humans, they will have to accept that. And I'm not sure if the Labour proposals really reflect that.
And Chris, I think over half of landlords actually say that they don't take pets. Do you think we're likely to see many responses from landlords if some kind of law like this were brought in?
I've got to say, I despair with this kind of announcement from the Labour Party at the moment. I mean, the NLA is completely neutral when it comes to party politics. But of all the things in housing that really demand attention, whether private tenants have the default right to a pet, I think is a bizarre choice. Not only because they already do. The law as written now, or at least case law and the way that consumers are protected, says that I can't refuse you the right to a pet unless I can give a valid reason. I can't put in a tenancy agreement, no pets, no questions. The position I have to take is, you have to ask me. But if I want to say no, I've got to do that for a valid reason. And I think that the point just raised about the cost of exiting these properties is really valid at the moment. The government is about to cap the amount of deposit that a landlord can require from a tenant. And the one way that actually facilitates tenants to get pets, particularly if we're talking about cats and dogs and things that do require cleaning, is an enhanced deposit. If we're not allowed to do that, I see that as a valid reason to say no, quite frankly.
And of course, the arguments that are put is that tenants will damage furniture or chew the woodwork of the property and etc. And this is why landlords often want high deposits.
If you count a dog as a tenant, I believe that would be a correct approach.
Yes.
It's very interesting. So yesterday when I was working on stories for The Negotiator, we were looking at some random postcodes and trying to work out how many adverts online on Rightmove featured no pets. And I know it wasn't the most scientific or wide-ranging research because I don't have that much time, but it would seem that I think probably at least 15 to 25% of all property letting adverts, say by landlords and agents, mention no pets or say preferred not to have pets. Mm. And even if you take the lower range of probably 10 to 15%, that's still a lot of properties in the UK.
Yes, I mean, it's an issue that I hear raised by tenants quite often, and I'm sure it's one that won't go away. Another case we've seen recently in the press is the single mother, Rosie Keogh, who successfully argued that blanket bans on benefit claimants indirectly discriminated against women, although it has to be said this was a settlement out of court. Do you think we're likely to see any implications here, Chris, for the wider market?
I doubt it in the short term. I mean, this is an interesting case because it's obviously based on indirect discrimination, and it's based on the fact that women and particularly single mothers are more likely to be reliant on benefits. And therefore, if you've got a completely business-focused and business case-focused policy that a landlord might reasonably have towards who they let to, it can disproportionately affect one group. Now, I think what's really interesting is this did settle out of court, so there's no precedent set. And although there have been quite a lot of reports that this is a major legal ruling that will mean that people have got to change the way they do business, that's not the case. But it does mean that I think probably letting agents a little more than landlords, but landlords as well, have got to make sure that they can defend their choices. So they've got to make sure that whilst you might still have a business that isn't viable if you accept LHA or Universal Credit tenants because it's simply not enough to cover the rent, you can demonstrate why that's the case. So you shouldn't be saying as a blanket that you're not accepting one type of tenant. But the really, really fascinating bit I've seen over the last few days is that they keep referring to rental hotspots where benefit tenants can't access property. They're called expensive areas. People who can't afford the rent in those areas can't afford to access the property. And whilst I've got every sympathy for people who are finding it more difficult to find a home, you know, it's a business decision that landlords are making.
Yes, I absolutely concur with this. I mean, I would love to take tenants with benefits, but I know that the LHA rates in the areas where I rent simply wouldn't cover the rent. And I look at the stats and see the level of arrears that a lot of landlords who take LHA tenants are in, and it's just too risky. What are your views on this, Nigel?
So just one update, which is that the government recently, the last week or so, relaxed the cap on the housing benefit rates. So that may alleviate that position. I don't think the relaxation they've introduced is going to really make any difference in the long term, particularly in what you refer to as these hotspots. My view is that the landlords out there should maybe have a think about what they're doing when they put no DSS on their adverts. I understand very clearly why they do that, and there are practical reasons for it. But in the broader, with a taking a more broader picture approach, is that they are helping facilitate a sort of almost sort of rental cleansing of some parts of our cities. And from my point of view, that's probably regrettable.
Okay, well, let's move on and take a look at some of the regulatory change that's going on. First one to start with is the redress scheme consultation. Consultation's going on now until the 16th of April, and the government is proposing that all landlords should be members of a redress scheme. Seems to me there are four key issues here. First of all, whether these should just cover self-managing landlords, so landlords who have agents wouldn't have to go into a redress scheme, because of course the agent has to be. Who provides the redress scheme? Also the cost of it, whether there's going to be a flat membership fee or whether landlords would have to pay per complaint, and also what the penalties for non-compliance might be. What are your reactions to the proposals, Chris?
It's a consultation, and I think in the way that the government is currently doing consultations, they're not very clear about exactly what they're proposing. So we've got to take everything with a bit of a pinch of salt. I think at the principle level, the concept seems sound. You know, letting agents have to be members of redress schemes, it does mean now that there's a divide in the market. If you go with a private landlord, you're not going to have access to ADR, alternative dispute resolution. If you go with a letting agent, you are. And it leads to a lot of confusion. So it, in a practical sense, it's worthwhile looking at this. What it's actually going to look like in practice, I mean, there's loads of question marks. And, you know, the government themselves have said they don't know if they want one overarching housing ombudsman or whether there should be competition. As soon as the Secretary of State made the announcement last year, the NLA went out to tender to find a redress scheme that would provide redress to all of our members to try and keep that cost down. We don't want landlords to have to incur a massive new cost. But quite frankly, if we can incur something very, very small where the polluter pays, quite frankly, if you're a repeat offender who's having lots of complaints made against you, it's probably quite right that you cover some of that cost. Then it seems like a fairly positive move for a professionalising market.
One of the possibilities here, of course, is that tenants could use the threat of a complaint to force landlords to take action, knowing that the landlord would then have to pay the redress scheme. Do you think this is a positive move forward, Nigel?
I think to reflect your comment there, or your question there, is that overall this is a system which is broken. Whatever you may think of the redress schemes, in general, my view is that, and from reporting on this for many years now, is that it is a broken system because it is so complicated that the vast majority of tenants and a lot of landlords don't really understand how it works. And therefore, you get, certainly even with the agent redress scheme, which is comparable, a lot of agents don't understand how it works, and a lot of their customers don't understand how it works, and therefore the numbers of agents struck off by the redress schemes, the number of agents who get fined by the, or asked to pay fines by the redress schemes, is very low, extremely low. And I think that's what's going to happen, even if we have a single housing ombudsman, is going to be so labyrinthine in its approach that it'll end up achieving very little. And I would prefer if it was much simpler. And I think that's most of the industry's view.
Yeah, I mean, I think you make a very good point there. I mean, even now with the letting agent schemes, there is a real lack of understanding from most quarters, really, about what the scheme's there for and what should go to court and what should go to a redress scheme. And the way we've approached this is you've obviously got the court there for criminal and most civil matters, quite frankly, in housing. But the redress scheme should be there for a service level dispute. But frankly, very few people know what that means. So they're not being used. The positive, and I think, and I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I think what the government wants to achieve with this is that almost to minimise its use. You know, if you've got landlords who want to avoid going to redress, they're more likely to, you know, resolve complaints early on. If it's like the letting agent scheme, the requirement is that you go through an internal complaints process first. You know, most thankfully now have them. If that was one positive to come out of it, they put in place complaints processes, and we expect landlords will have to do the same, although, you know, largely to a smaller scale, and that will be the positive. But I completely agree, if there's going to be redress, particularly if it's going to cost us something, it needs to be simple enough to use.
The other issue I have with this is that Karen Buck's bill on fitness for human habitation is working its way through Parliament at the moment, and the government is supporting that. Now, the tenant will have the right to take legal action for breach of contract if the conditions of the property are not fit for human habitation. And I'm wondering if we're kind of duplicating things here, Chris.
I'm not sure if it's a straightforward duplication, as I said, but I think this does highlight the point we just made about the complexities. You know, what that bill is doing is duplicating your right to go to court, but we know that that also is a real barrier to tenants trying to get things done. The reason that we at the NLA have supported Karen Buck's bill is we don't think actually it imposes any new measures on landlords who are complying with the law. You know, if you've got a property which isn't fit for human habitation, you'll get an improvement notice served, and any landlord worth their salt should fix it before that point, but should certainly fix it then. So if the tenant gets the right to go to court afterwards and sue you for damages, well, you should have done what you were supposed to do in the first place. So I don't have a major issue there with any duplication. With redress, I don't think that kind of matter should be brought before a redress provider. There might be a complaint that you don't... I suppose the area that it could cross over is on timescales. If you've got a landlord who routinely carries out improvement works or repairs, but not in a very timely manner, then yes, you might find that there's an issue with an improvement notice and a redress case. But again, it's a landlord just not doing their job properly.
Nigel, housing charities and homelessness charities complain that the stock in the private rented sector is often worse than that of the social sector. Do you think Karen Buck's bill on fitness for human habitation is going to change that?
The intentions behind her bill are extremely laudable, and that's why she's had cross-party support, and it's very likely going to become law unless basically Brexit gets in the way, I think. So from that point of view, it's clearly a brilliant piece of legislation, and it's an ethical piece of legislation, and no one disagrees with what she's up to. I think a lot of landlords are worried that by introducing it, it gives another avenue of opportunity for tenants to delay being exited or evicted from properties. And that, I think, there is some criticism around that, but it's unlikely given that the problems that we're talking about are huge. I mean, we're talking about holes in roofs and boilers which blow up. We're not talking about worn carpet and you know, it's very serious stuff.
I think what's really interesting there, I mean, yes, you're right. If you've got disrepair, that can be a delaying tactic. And, you know, agencies out there are advising people to stay put. What's really interesting in the disparity between private property and social, the landlords who are really worried by this bill are social landlords, because this bill will actually give a lot more power to social tenants to do something. If you're a tenant of the local council, you're complaining to your landlord and trying to get legal action taken by your landlord against your landlord. It's almost impossible. Whereas this is probably the one lever they'll be able to pull to threaten to get damages.
That's actually a very important point, isn't it, Chris, that the bill will cover both private and social sectors. Well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. I'm chewing over the latest developments in the world of property with my guests, Chris Norris, Director of Policy and Practice at the National Landlords Association, and Nigel Lewis, Head of Content at The Negotiator. Well, let's move on to some other regulatory changes. Gas and electrical safety is hitting the headlines at the moment, isn't it, Chris? First of all, we've got these kind of MOT-style changes to gas safety certificates. Tell us about that.
The MOT style check is really, really welcome. I mean, I'm happy to say that the NLA, particularly our members actually, provided a lot of evidence to the HSC in formulating this policy, played quite a role. We've had an increasing problem, and so have social landlords, to give them their due, gaining access to properties at the right time to carry out the legal duty to have gas safety checks carried out. So every year you've got to have a check done. But if the tenant doesn't let you in, it's their home, and there's very little you can do, and it's a very lengthy process to get an injunction to be allowed in to carry out a check, and it leads to the breakdown of tenancies, and it leads to landlords breaking the law and committing criminal offences by not having the checks done. So what this will do will allow, in the same way that you would with your car MOT, would allow the renewal date for that certificate to be a bit more flexible. You can go in up to 2 months before the certificate expires, carry out the check, but not lose those 2 months. Because we estimated that I think we were losing about a year for every 9 years of being a landlord in terms of those checks.
There's also been a court case recently, actually, about gas safety certificates, hasn't there, Chris? Which is where it was a county court appeal of Carradon Property Limited versus Monty Schultz, to be precise. And the appeal said that the Section 21 notice that had been served was invalid because the gas safety certificate had not been served before the tenant occupied the property. Bit of a worrying change, isn't that?
It's definitely worrying. Whether or not it's a change is a bit debatable. We've been going through this in quite some detail. What's happened here is the landlord has had the gas safety check carried out, but they've not provided the certificate before the tenants moved in. Now, there's nothing new about that requirement. It's a piece of criminal legislation to say you have to serve that for a new tenant. And I think when you have a new check carried out within about 30 days, I may be wrong on that. The change is the sanction and whether the sanction is proportionate, because it's always been a criminal offence not to do that. So no change at all in that respect. But since the Deregulation Act came in and introduced the requirement to serve certain documents and prescribed information at the beginning of a tenancy, this new sanction of not being able to serve a valid Section 21 comes into place. Now, we've discussed this with what is now the Ministry, and it doesn't seem like this was their intention, but we're in another one of those situations similar to tenancy deposit protection over the last few years, where the legislation hasn't been drafted quite tightly enough and we've got some consequences. So the question we're asking at the moment is it proportional to create an assured tenancy if you forget to bring the gas safety certificate with you on check-in, which seems to be the kind of thing that's happening at the moment.
Yes, and of course the list of documents that has to be given to the tenant at the start of the tenancy in order for you to be able to then serve a Section 21 gets longer and longer, doesn't it, Nigel? I mean, I sometimes feel like, you know, that this is a sort of backdoor way of sort of eroding the Section 21 option.
For me, it's all about whether a landlord and a tenant have a good relationship. And I suspect the vast majority of landlords and tenants in the UK have perfectly normal, what is basically a business relationship. You have a property, I rent it, you pay me rent, etc., etc. That's fine. And and all of these things that we're talking about with this, particularly this eviction process change that we're talking about here, don't apply, because it never gets to that. Where this goes horribly wrong and where these sort of rules suddenly become very live for landlords is when they, without expecting it, suddenly have a terrible relationship with their tenant, or they get a problem tenant who's this tricky. And this is when, for the very small percentage of cases where this goes wrong, this becomes a huge problem, and lawyers get involved and magistrates get involved and everything else gets horribly involved. All I would say is that I would wish the government would spend as much effort trying to encourage landlords and tenants to have good relationships together as they did trying to enforce these rather arcane laws, which to lead them by the nose into good behaviour.
Gosh, I couldn't agree more with that. I mean, I always say to landlords that I meet at meetings that, you know, at least 60% of success in your business is your relationship with your tenant, and you know, which is why a kind of induction meeting at the start and all those kinds of things is so important.
Bottle of champagne when they move in, that's what I say.
It's usually Carver actually for me, but maybe I'm not. Maybe I need to go more upmarket. On a more serious note, actually, Nigel, there's been a campaign by Eddie Hughes MP to introduce requirement for mandatory carbon monoxide alarms in properties. Currently, you only have to have them in a rented property if there's a solid fuel appliance like a wood burn or something like that, but he wants it to be changed so that any fuel burning appliance, so for example a boiler, if you had one of those in a property, which most of us have of course, you would have to have a carbon monoxide alarm. And he reminds us that carbon monoxide kills 50 people every year and injures thousands. Do you think this is a regulation too far or something that we need?
So on the one hand, having watched the videos of the stories that he's put on his website about some of the people who died, or the parents talking about people who've died, are just heartbreaking. And I can see why, even though he's a Conservative MP, he speaks like a Labour MP when he is describing the legislation he wants to bring in, because it is about caring for tenants, and that's brilliant. On the other hand, I think it's unnecessary, because I wish that more landlords would just be reasonable and spend the £20-30 it costs to buy a carbon monoxide alarm and stick it in and just everyone do it. It's not a lot of money. Even in the cheapest rental flat, it's not a lot of money. It's the price of a couple of beers down the pub. I know I'll probably get flack for saying that, but you know what I mean? It's not very expensive. Come on, landlords, just do it.
Well, I'd be interested to hear Chris's take on that. And also, Chris, of course, we've got yet another consultation, again, till the 16th of April, on mandatory electrical safety consultation. How are landlords viewing all of these changes, Chris?
How landlords are viewing them, and exactly my view, might not be exactly the same in this, which isn't great for the NLA, I suppose. I mean, on carbon monoxide, I've met Eddie a few times about this. He's completely sincere. And it's interesting you say he sounds more like a Labour MP, because his brother is a Labour councillor who's also, you know, been involved in advising him on this. Just fit carbon monoxide alarms. I could not understand the motivation of the government when they introduced the last regulation to restrict it to solid fuel appliances. If you've got a gas appliance, yes, there are technical reasons why it's less likely there will be a carbon monoxide incident. But they do cost £20. They have 7 or 10 year sealed batteries. You don't need to touch them again. You know, beside testing, that's it. Just fit them. It's not worth the hassle. And we've supported Eddie. I agree. I wish we didn't need the regulation for this. But you know, whilst fitting of these detectors has improved, it's not universal. I'd like to see it across all tenure. You know, forget whether it's rental or not. Just fit them everywhere. On electrical safety. Electrical safety, there's a bigger cost involved, so I can completely understand why landlords are a bit dubious at the moment about whether there's a need for this. But from the NLA's point of view, we sat on the ministerial group advising this issue, and I've got to say, we could see no reasonable justification to try and block this change. You know, the risks may be low, but there's a lot of very old and potentially dangerous wiring in housing stock across the UK. It's not just in the private rented sector, but if you're not living in that property and you're responsible for its safety, you are less likely to see if there's an issue and less likely to be live to it. And from our point of view, if you're going to be held responsible for anything that goes wrong later down the line, you might as well check and do everything you can to make sure you've carried out your due diligence. And if we need a nudge by saying every 5 years you have a check, I think that's the route we've got to go down.
Just chatting to landlords, I've heard some say they're concerned that electricians will try profiteering through this new measure, because they'll say that lots of stuff needs to be changed. And also there's a concern about whether we've got enough electricians to suddenly have to carry out these checks of all of those millions of properties that are privately rented. Do you think this is viable, Nigel?
Well, gosh, so there's a comparable argument with the HIPs. For the properties which were sold, which the Labour government tried to bring in, which is that a whole industry sprang up of HIPs inspectors, so that may not necessarily be a bad thing. However, I think that if there is some worries around electricians taking advantage of the fact that the property may or may not need work, I mean, it's just got to live with it. We live with it with garages and engineers. And we live with several other industries where we're basically open to that sort of abuse. You just got to be on it. If you know your property well and you're a landlord and you understand what it does and doesn't need, then you will know whether an electrician is taking the mickey. If you don't know your property very well and you very rarely visit it and you very rarely look at it, then you're sort of, well, it's your fault really if then the electrician takes advantage of you. I'm sorry.
Related to this, there's been a case actually with a landlord in Accrington called Paul Brown, supported by the RLA. He was required to install carbon monoxide detectors and carry out electrical safety checks as part of the licensing process by his local authority. But he argued that such standards through licensing schemes went beyond the powers available to local authorities, and the Court of Appeal agreed. Do you think this is a sensible result, Chris?
Oh, it's a very, very difficult on this, because on the technical point of whether the local authority had the legal right to impose the conditions, the court's right. They overstepped what they're allowed to do. Should this case ever have been taken up on what are effectively safety grounds, I would say no. And it comes back to Nigel's point before. I wish we didn't need regulation for these simple points. You know, we shouldn't be quibbling in the courts about whether you should make sure that my property is safe. National legislation already says I have to make sure it's safe. And, you know, being a human and letting to other humans says I should make sure it's safe. It should have been a moot point. And in fact, to give this landlord his due, he was already compliant. This was testing the technical range of a local authority, and, you know, well done for testing that. But this really shouldn't have been the point that we had to make.
It's kind of about landlords getting frustrated with local authorities overstepping their powers, and particularly because it's so easy for local authorities to bring in licensing schemes. I mean, do you empathise at all here with the landlords, Nigel?
Yes, I do. I've seen the reams and reams and reams of online rants against local authorities, and I've read them, and I disagree with some of it, and I agree with other parts, which is that it is frustrating enough being a landlord, dealing with the sort of slings and arrows of legislation, tenants, breakages, all that other stuff, and then to face your area becoming licensed or your type of property being licensed nationally or by local authority can be very annoying. And I understand that landlords are, against that sort of thing. On the other hand, if you talk to local authorities, the vast majority of the offices you talk to on the ground have good intentions, which is to stop tenants being taken advantage of and properties being rented out, which are substandard or very substandard. And I think it's a shame that the two sides don't really talk enough on this level about this sort of thing.
On the subject of licensing, the new definition of an HMO, house in multiple occupation, has been confirmed that it's going to come in on the 1st of October in England. So five people living in two or more households, regardless of the number of stories, currently it's in three stories or more, a property in those circumstances would require a mandatory HMO license. There's going to be passporting over from additional licensing into mandatory licensing if you already have an additional license in local authority areas that require them. What do you think will be the impact of this new definition coming in from October, Chris?
I think we've got to be a little bit careful. They keep correcting me over at the ministry. It's apparently not a change in definition, but a change in scope. And I'm not entirely certain what the difference is. But you're right. The way you've explained it is absolutely correct. It's smaller properties, but with lots of households. In numerical terms, it's about 160,000 additional properties coming into scope. But because there is no overarching oversight for licensing schemes, we've no idea how many of those are already licensed under discretionary schemes and therefore need to be passported. So we're probably looking at a smaller number that are going to require a license. The impact is going to be broken down by region. You know, this was seen to be necessary because there are certain parts of the country where there are large HMOs, but very few three-storey properties. For instance, if you look at Milton Keynes, Milton Keynes have had lots of different attempts to license types of property or to challenge the government for various definitions, because as a new town, most of the properties sprung up on a certain architectural style and they don't fit licensing. So in areas like that, you'll see lots of properties needing to be licensed and you know, lots of landlords having to deal with the HMO management requirements, which is going to be a steep learning curve. In the scale of the whole private rented sector, it's pretty much a drop in the ocean. But for those directly impacted, it's going to be costly, if nothing else.
The Labour Party is very keen on licensing, Nigel. In fact, has talked about a national register or encourages local authorities to have licensing schemes. What do you think about these changes?
So I absolutely agree with everything Chris has just said. And so from a technical point of view, I'm not going to add much to that. But from a political point of view, I can understand why the Labour Party are keen on this, because I think landlords should look at HMOs slightly differently than they do. And certainly a lot of the HMO landlords I talk to seem to see it as HMOs is a way to make lots of money, and not necessarily relatively easily, but they tend to be more profitable than more standard properties. But you have to look at it is that it's meeting a need, which is there are very, very vulnerable people who don't earn much, who need sort of okay accommodation, and they don't want luxury apartments. They just want somewhere safe and clean to live, and they don't have friends and family to live with, and that's what HMOs provide. And I think the Labour Party's approach is the correct one, which is that we should therefore tighten the rules up around how we provide that type of housing to these sorts of people, because they are more vulnerable than middle income or low middle income families and couples and fresh out of university people in the centre of cities who are going to their first jobs, I would say.
Okay, and we've seen another change, actually, which was snuck in December, Chris, to do with Article 4 planning permission fees. It's a little bit complicated, isn't it? Do you want to try and give a pithy explanation?
Pithy? I had a feeling you were going to raise this one. I know Article 4 directions are one of your bugbears. You're right, it was snuck in. We didn't notice immediately until it was brought to our attention by a member via one of our regional rep network. Essentially, an Article 4 direction removes the right to permitted development in any particular property. So normally it's conservation areas. If you live in a street of Victorian homes and the council's worried that you're going to put in new PVC windows and replace the original sashes, they use an Article 4 to remove the right to do that. Since a government change a few years ago and the requirement for planning permission for small HMOs came into force, they can use them to prevent landlords taking what they would deem a family home and making it an HMO. But the overriding or almost the saving provision of Article 4 was a council can do that, but they can't charge you for making the application. So they can't create a revenue stream by removing all the rights and then making you apply to get them back. The change in December, well, it did two things. It took away that provision, so they now can charge for that application, and they doubled the fee. So now not only can they can charge, and I've forgotten the exact figure, somewhere over £400 for an application for planning permission, which may be granted or denied.
I think it's £462. And what worries me about this is there's a perverse incentive then for local authorities to introduce Article 4 directions.
There really is. We genuinely thought, we tried to give the government the benefit of the doubt, we genuinely thought this might have been an oversight. And whilst the intention was to increase the fee, and we know planning fees have been going up for a number of years, we thought the extension of the right to charge to Article 4 areas was something that had slipped through and we would be able to get corrected relatively simply. I'm sorry to say that doesn't seem to be the case. The only saving grace at the moment, and it might not be the same after this gets broadcast, is we don't think many local authorities have realised yet. So, in fact, the anecdote that goes with our finding out about this, we found out because a landlord in a particular local area made more than 100 applications for planning permission in one go. And when the council asked, why are you doing this now? It was to get in before the charge could be levied. And that's what woke them up to the issue, and they now want to begin charging. So we're not sure exactly what the impact will be around the country. You don't have to charge. I can't see many authorities turning down the chance to charge. When they find out.
So if you don't agree with this provision, make sure you don't tell your local authority about it. Some final thoughts on what's going on with the market. I was looking at the Office of National Statistics figures on increases in rental prices, and to January 2018, they just increased by 1.1% across Great Britain and 0.2% in London. These are the lowest figures since the series began in January 2012. What are you detecting in the market, Nigel, and what's happening?
Well, the lettings market is, and always will be, one of the great contradictions on this planet. The letting agents, when the fees ban was announced, said that even before the fees ban came in, it would start to reduce the number of landlords, and also renting property out, and also the tax changes, which I'm sure all landlords are now aware of, would have the same effect. Perversely, and would therefore push up rents as more tenants went for fewer homes. Perversely, this is not happening, and a lot of the rental indexes show flat or slightly reducing, as you've just mentioned, rents, and they're reducing because they're going up less than inflation. So you can say that tenants are sort of getting their homes cheaper, and landlords are not. So. My view is that I think eventually the tax changes and the fees ban will feed through to higher rents in some areas which are popular in city centres.
Chris, the NLA has spent a number of years defending higher rents, often in media interviews. Is it some welcome relief for tenants here?
I mean, I'm not sure we've been defending higher rents necessarily, but pointing out there's a difference between speed and acceleration. We accept that rents are very high, particularly in London and certain parts of the country. What we've been very keen to say over the years is actually they're not increasing, they're not accelerating at the rate that people tend to imply. They talk about rocketing rents. Well, no, they're at a very high altitude, but they're not necessarily getting any higher. I think this is what's being pointed out. The ONS figures that have run for the last 6 or 7 years have never really got above about 2% year on year. So they're lower, but they've never been that high, and they've normally been around the CPI rate. So no enormous change there. But I completely agree with what Nigel said there. There's a lot of scaremongering about there's going to be a knee jerk and rents are going to jump immediately with these policy changes. They're not going to jump immediately, but as landlords deal with increased costs, I mean, I'm one of those landlords who waits until the January deadline to fill in their tax return, and I've started to see that these tax changes are having an impact, and we're only 25% of the way in. You know, give that 3 more years, and landlords like me are going to have no choice but to test the elasticity of the rents in my area. You know, there's no other way to cover my costs. So I think we can enjoy the relatively low increase at the moment, you know, maybe a bit of respite from skyrocketing rent stories, but it's going to be short-lived.
Okay, well, that's it for this programme. My thanks to my guests, Nigel Lewis and Chris Norris, and to you for listening. You can get in touch with the programme by going to insideproperty.org.uk. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.